The Wonderland Murders by Hollywood and Crime contains depictions of violence and is not suitable for everyone. Please be advised.
We are entering the northwest bedroom where victim number two is located. There is evidence of ransacking in this room. In front of you, we have the west wall, blood splattered. This was the location that victim number five was removed by a rescue unit. As we move to the south, we suddenly
Tracy McCourt fiddled with the radio dial as he sat behind the wheel of the 75 Ford Granada. He looked over at the white stone house again, squinting in the bright morning light. Ron Lanius, Billy Deverell, and David Lind had been in there for 20 minutes. The plan had been to get in through an open door in the back, grab whatever they could in cash, drugs, and jewels, and get out. Then McCourt would gun the engine for the quick ride back to Wonderland. For a few seconds, he thought he heard voices, but couldn't be sure. Not finding a song to his liking, he flicked the radio off. He went back to reading his newspaper. Suddenly, a muffled gunshot pierced the still morning air. McCourt dropped the paper on his lap. He looked back at the house, cursing under his breath. The guns had been for show. No one was supposed to get hurt. From Wondery, this is The Wonderland Murders by Hollywood and Crime. I'm Tracy Patton with our writer-director, Larry Brand. If you're joining us for the first time, we recommend you go back and listen to the previous episodes in order. We'll be waiting for you. Today's episode, The Inside Man. Here's my co-host, Larry Brand.
No one knows where John is. The scene's been blocked, the actress is on set, but the leading man is nowhere to be found. By now, the crew knows the routine. They check the bathroom first, then the rest of the location house. The director shoots any scenes he can think of that don't involve the star. They hold out hope that John has simply taken a long lunch. But when someone notices his car in the parking lot, the search intensifies. Running out of material to shoot, the director finally decides to wrap for the day. It's then that they hear a woman's startled scream. Rushing over, they find the actress staring into a tiny closet in one of the bedrooms. John is curled up into a ball, hunched fetally over a glass pipe. He's been in there for hours, freebasing cocaine. When they try to coax him out, he shrinks away from them, murmuring that he's afraid. John's agent, on set that day to help out with production, gently tries to coax his client from his hiding spot. "What are you afraid of?" he asks. But John just shakes his head, holding the pipe protectively as if it were an infant. Or a talisman of great power.
Within days of the Wonderland murders, detectives Tom Lang and Robert Souza thought they understood the basic facts. From the story David Lynn told them, the killings were revenge for a robbery at Eddie Nash's house that had taken place 2 days earlier. But the testimony of a multiple convicted felon would need strong corroboration. Moreover, Lynn hadn't been present during the murders and could only give the background of the likely scenario. The police in DA's office had been hopeful that the lone survivor of the massacre, Susan Lanius, might be able to provide more information. She had been under 24-hour police protection at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Beverly Hills, where she remained in critical condition. She had suffered several skull fractures, numerous cuts and abrasions, and had lost the tip of her right pinky finger. Doctors performed multiple surgeries, one of which removed a large fragment of her skull. The trauma to her brain had caused a partial paralysis of her left leg. When she was able to talk to police, there was little she could tell them. Due to the head injuries, her memory of the events that night was clouded and incomplete. She recalled lying in bed beside Ron, watching television. Perhaps she dozed off. Suddenly, several people were moving quickly around the house. There were loud, cracking sounds. a flash of intense pain and an explosion of red. Footsteps on the stairs and someone yelling. Again and again, the banging sound. Then she was choking and vomiting blood. The pain engulfed her entire body. When asked for a description of the assailant, she could only describe them as shadows. She remembered one of the intruders had dark eyes. They looked right through her. Someone was saying, "Hit him again." A large shape hovered over Ron Lanius, striking him over and over. Then she descended into unconsciousness. The next thing she remembered was a voice saying she was going to die. "Just take the shit and get out. The bitch is going to die anyway."
Even John's old friend, director Bob Chin, is losing his patience. John's increasing drug use is interfering with his ability to maintain an erection. Movies made on a 1 or 2 day shooting schedule can't afford to lose time coaxing an actor from the bathroom and then waiting around until he's ready to perform. Everyone has started to recognize the wild mood swings brought on by the drug. The rush makes the already manic John uncontrollable. The crash makes him moody and difficult. Worse yet, when he isn't doing drugs or giving half-hearted efforts, he's sneaking around looking for something to steal. Tools would disappear from the set. Actresses would have their purses rifled. Location owners would later find items missing: cash, jewelry, drugs, anything John can sell, snort, or smoke. Other producers have learned to avoid him. Though his day rate has soared to an unprecedented $3,000, more and more of it is being used to buy drugs. As his growing addiction and unreliability make him less and less employable, the money for drugs begins to dry up. Bob feels sorry for the man who put them both on the marquee with the Johnny Wad movies. He takes his star out for lunch at Musso and Frank's to talk to him about it. John can barely sit still, disappearing into the men's room every few minutes for a hit. Rather than making any attempt to curb his use, John winds up trying to sell cocaine to the director. Though occasionally indulging himself, Bob Chin has learned better than to buy from John. The product would invariably be cut with vitamin C or baby laxative, giving John an opportunity to skim, and the buyer a case of the runs. As more and more directors stop calling, John looks increasingly strung out. Sallow-cheeked and sunken-eyed, he repeats the junkie mantra. He promises to change, asks for another chance to prove himself, then betrays whatever trust he's been given. In the end, the porn industry is a business like any other. John's main asset, many would say his only asset, is no longer reliable. Productions can't afford to wait around while their leading man pretends he'll be ready to roll right after the next bathroom break. Then comes the day Bob Chin finds John's coke stash on set. He calls the actor over. Haven't they agreed this shit would stop? That what John did on his own time was his business, but he needed to respect Bob's set? John tries his ingratiating grin, but this time it isn't working. The crew grows quiet, sensing this confrontation is beyond normal shoot disagreements. Then Bob pushes open the bathroom door and empties John's cocaine into the toilet. He looks back at the actor. "Have you got your paycheck yet?" John shakes his head, but his attention is fixed on the water swirling in the toilet, taking his day's supply down into the LA sewer system. "Then I suggest you pick up your check and don't come back," Bob Chin says. With that, he turns away and walks back to the set. The relationship that spanned the Johnny Wad franchise is over.
Susan Lanius' testimony offered few details useful to authorities, and David Lynn's criminal career rendered him far from an ideal witness. But there was another member of the Wonderland gang who had survived the night of murder. Whether by prudence or dumb luck, he had been miles away during the carnage. Tom Lang didn't think there was much man behind the brush mustache worn by Tracy McCourt. The detective and his partner, Bob Souza, found the Wonderland gang wheelman sitting in county jail on a grand theft charge. When they brought him in for questioning, neither cop was surprised when he began by lying. He didn't know about the murders, didn't know about any robbery, couldn't find Wonderland on a map. But that didn't last long, with the hulking Souza towering over him, playing up the tough cop. Pretty soon, the scrawny addict was trading what he knew for smokes, confirming what they'd already heard from David Lind. Yes, he could fill in the details of the robbery committed 2 days before the murders. Yes, he'd been the getaway driver. Truth was, he was more afraid of Eddie Nash than the cops. But Tracy McCourt was in no position to bargain.
"Let's take a drive," says Chris Cox to John Holmes one night. A member in good standing of the Lavender Hill mob, LA's gay mafia, Chris met John earlier in the year when a mutual acquaintance introduced them at the Odyssey nightclub on Beverly Boulevard. Chris immediately recognized the porn star and warmed to him. He'd been a fan of John's film since he was in his teens. But it was a mutual interest in cocaine that bonded them. Chris was running the club at the time, but maintained a side operation dealing coke to a select clientele. John made an unreliable customer as money from his dwindling career was drying up. By now, Chris could distinguish the few who could handle the drug from the many who couldn't. When John didn't have the cash to pay for the next hit, Chris would take mercy on him, sharing from his personal stash. John understood that one way to have drugs was to deal drugs, so he was always looking for potential small-time clients he could sell to while acting as middleman. He would scour the clubs for some clique of valley teens out for a big night in Hollywood. John would sell them a few grams of highly cut product and use what was left. But on this night, Chris tells John he's dry. Demand has been high and he's run out. Chris can see John's in a bad way, so they head out to Studio City to see a dealer Chris knows. They can hear music and voices from inside the white stone house as they pull up to the curb at Donna Lola Place. A knot of cars clogs the driveway. The first thing John notices as they enter is the half dozen or so young girls sauntering around naked. Normally that would get his attention, but right now he's got a more pressing need. An enormous black bodyguard casts lidded eyes in their direction. Recognizing Chris with an expressionless nod, he quickly loses interest. On a couch near the center of the room, a wiry, dark-haired man sits hunched over a freebase pipe. He takes in a deep lungful, letting it go slowly. He's wearing bikini briefs, a satin robe hanging open. His eyes are glazed, but they focus on John as the two new arrivals approach. Before Chris can introduce them, the man jumps up from the couch, coming over with hand outstretched. "I know exactly who you are," says Eddie Nash. "I watched all your movies, big fan." He quickly forgets about Chris and ushers John over to the sofa, telling him how he often rents office space to porn production companies. In fact, he's thought about getting involved in the business himself. He's certain there's money to be made there. He considers John a true superstar of the industry. "Sit, you play baseball?" Eddie hands John the glass pipe and holds the flame to it. John watches the fine powder bubble as his lungs fill with the warm vapor and his head begins to swim. He closes his eyes and lets the rush take him to that familiar place where nothing matters. When his eyes open again, he's looking at Eddie's grinning face. Eddie takes another hit, and the world is a warm and peaceful place.
Tracy McCourt told the detectives everything. He admitted being part of the Wonderland Gang, even though his criminal record paled in comparison to that of hardened cons Ron Lanius and David Lind. In fact, Lynn called him Titmouse Tracy, a nickname emphasizing his disdain. But McCourt wasn't about to take on the tattooed biker if respect came at the risk of a beating or worse. Nor had Tracy argued on the morning of June 29th when Lind had relieved him of his handgun and told him today he'd be doing the driving. The plan had been simple. Their inside man would spend the night at Eddie's house getting high. He'd excuse himself to use the bathroom, then sneak into the back bedroom and unlatch the sliding door. Then he'd return to Wonderland and inform the gang the operation was a go. Of course, with Lanius and Deverell, schedules were unpredictable at best. They were sleeping off their last heroin fix and couldn't be roused till later in the morning. By the time they were alert and arming themselves, the sun was up. But they had their floor plan of the house, knew where the bedroom safe was, where the bodyguard slept, where drugs and cash were likely to be found. They were going to burst in posing as police officers using stolen badges Lind had acquired. Before Eddie and his man knew what hit them, they'd be cuffed and helpless. Ron Lanius had applied liquid Band-Aid to the gang's fingertips to avoid leaving prints. But he was confident the robbery would go unreported. Most of what they'd be taking would be drugs and unlaundered cash. Even the jewelry was likely to be hot. Thieves and drug dealers don't file police reports, Lanius assured them. In the heroin haze of the Wonderland house, it all seemed to make sense.
At first, Sharon notices things missing from around the house. An item of jewelry here and there, maybe a small appliance or piece of furniture. One day she opens a cabinet to discover an empty shelf where the china set should be. As a nurse, she can't ignore the mounting signs of addiction. He's become increasingly irritable, jumpy, on edge. His schedule, always erratic, is even less reliable. He leaves or returns at all hours, constantly checking his answering service for messages. She knows, or assumes, he has other girlfriends. But this goes beyond that. 1 month, when she checks her credit card statement, she discovers John's racked up nearly $50,000 in purchases. She peruses the list. Jewelry, furniture, household appliances, TVs, the kinds of things that can easily be fenced or pawned for the quick cash to buy drugs. Still, she avoids confrontation. Rather, she calls the bank and separates her account and credit cards from her husband's. Living in the same small house, Sharon insulates herself even more from the man who still shares her bed. By now, she's gotten used to the obvious fact that John is sleeping with Dawn, the teenage girl from their complex. She can't say she really cares, and if it bothers her that she doesn't care, she never lets him see it. She no longer has the energy or desire to confront her husband. The last thing she wants is another of his groveling denials. She observes John's transparent courtship of the teenager. He hides small items around the house, a stuffed animal or trinket, and gives them to her when he thinks Sharon doesn't notice. At first, he made a show of how innocent it all was, taking the two sisters on day trips to the woods or beach. Pretty soon, it's just the two of them, and the excursions have become overnight ventures. John doesn't talk about it, and Sharon doesn't ask. It's become an unspoken ritual between them. It's been a long time since she's had romantic feelings for him, and longer still since they had sexual relations. John's life is his. John doesn't tell her about the night he and Dawn spend in his van having sex for the first time. He doesn't tell her about the drugs they share, the endless hours of driving the streets of LA in search of the next high, the rituals he shares only with Dawn as their eyes glow orange and blue with the flames of the freebase pipe, as they disappear together in the endorphin rush, that perfect state of bliss, or how, when the last rock is gone, they scrape the pipe bowl of its residue and ash, chasing that ever-diminishing high, how they fall together in a tense sweat of need and absence, sleeping it off until they wake with a new hunger. But there are some things Sharon can't ignore. One night, John comes home following the premiere of one of his films. She watches as, without a word, he takes off his boots and socks to reveal a thick bundle of large denomination bills. He asks her to count it. She takes the bills and sorts them on the table. Over $50,000 in cash. She knows immediately it didn't come from any film shoot. What she doesn't know is that in order to support his growing cocaine habit, he's begun a second career as a courier between rival LA drug dealers.
Tracy McCord got behind the wheel of the stolen Granada and awaited further instructions. Sometime after 8 in the morning, Lanius, Lind, and Deverell piled into the car and they headed the short distance to Eddie Nash's house. En route, they saw a Chevy Malibu approaching from the opposite direction. The cars pulled adjacent to each other. The man behind the wheel of the Malibu nodded, giving them the go-ahead. McCourt took this to mean he'd left a sliding door to the victim's house unlocked. Lanius nodded and McCourt gunned the engine. As the two cars went in their different directions, the man in the Malibu yelled, "Get him!" and gave that stupid grin of his. Moments later, the Granada pulled over in front of the large, well-tended home at 3315 Donna Lola Place. McCourt remained behind the wheel while the other three men got out. He watched as they walked up the driveway and disappeared behind the house.
John Holmes watches the chute spit suitcases onto the luggage carousel. Occasionally, he flicks a glance at the waiting passengers as they search for their bags. Hat pulled low over his forehead, hiding his shaggy curls, he slinks closer to the carousel, avoiding eye contact. This is not the place to be recognized as Johnny Wadd, the king of porn. When he spots a piece that looks good, maybe a brand name that's not overly worn, he reaches down casually and hoists it off the mechanism. He's got his wrap down in case the owner happens to be nearby. Oh, sorry, it looks just like mine. But today things go well. In a few minutes, he's back in his car, parked at LAX's short-term lot. It's a hit-or-miss operation. He might go through several bags before hitting pay dirt, a piece of jewelry or expensive suit. Driving to the airport to swipe an unguarded piece of luggage has become routine. As his drug habit grows and his dependability on the set diminishes, John not only loses his regular paycheck, but the opportunity to steal from location houses. The adult film world is small, and his reputation for erratic behavior quickly spreads, making him less and less employable. When even his old friend Bob Chin won't hire him, John looks for new ways to sustain his addiction. No longer able to maintain an erection, he works a few soft core shoots, including Disco Sex Party and John Holmes and the All-Star Sex Queens. He spends breaks in the bathroom with his briefcase now fitted with a glass pipe, baking soda, and petri dish for cooking the powdered cocaine into base. A bottle of 151-proof rum has replaced the JMB. Cotton balls are soaked in the rum to light the pipe. When the rock in the bowl is used up, John scrapes the charred resin from the screens and smokes that, continuing the process until nothing remains. Then he chases the freebase with a fistful of Valium to take the edge off the high. John steals from Sharon and any friends trusting enough to allow him an unwatched moment. One couple makes the mistake of letting him know they'll be away for the morning, only to find their house emptied of valuables when they get home. He rifles through drawers on film sets and breaks into parked cars to steal anything left in view. Most profitable, though, is serving as a middleman for drug deals. This affords him an opportunity to get high, make a few dollars, and siphon off whatever dope he can when no one's looking. As his friendship with Eddie Nash blossoms, such opportunities become more frequent. When it comes to drugs, Eddie is big time. Impressed with John's status in the X-rated world, the club owner invites him over to his Studio City house, introduces him to friends at parties, seems to take pride in calling him brother. John wanders the halls, noticing the Rembrandt on the walls, the piles of cash and drugs lying haphazardly about. Eddie is generous with his cocaine, but increasingly it comes with a price tag. Assessing his friend is on the downside of his film career, Eddie starts offering him small errands to run, and John soon falls into the role of delivery boy between high-level drug dealers. John sometimes repays Eddie's generosity by providing him with young women he's met at the clubs or on film shoots. But John's addiction is always a step or two ahead of his ability to make good, and Eddie always keeps track of the balance sheet. One night, in an attempt to square accounts, John tells a stripper acquaintance about Nash. Eddie's always looking to replenish his supply of women, and maybe she's interested. When she asks what he's like, John says, Eddie might be kinky, but he pays well. How well, she wants to know. $500 worth of well, says John. They get in John's car and drive over to see the nightclub impresario. John gets high and leaves. The next day, the woman is found dead in the parking lot of one of Nash's clubs. It looks like an overdose, though her friends insist she never shot up. There is no police investigation.
As Tracy McCourt sat behind the wheel of the stolen Granada, he heard voices and looked out the passenger side window. Ron Lanius, David Lind, and Billy Deverell were coming out of Eddie Nash's house, tucking their handguns into their waistbands. They were carrying an attaché case, a metal cash box, and a shower curtain fashioned into a bag to transport more goods. Wads of cash were falling out of Billy's pockets, and he was stopping every few feet to scoop them up. The men jumped into the car, still buzzed from the success of their operation. McCourt hit the gas and they headed back toward Wonderland. When he asked about the gunshot, Lanius fumed at Lind, though he seemed equally amused and angry about the incident. Lind's gun had gone off accidentally, grazing Nash's bodyguard. Suddenly, the Granada sputtered and died. They all looked at the gas gauge. Fucking idiot, Lanius glared at McCourt. Their getaway driver had forgotten to put gas in the car. Fortunately, they were headed downhill and managed to half-coast, half-power their way back to Wonderland. They spent the rest of the halting ride bragging about the success of the job, how much cash and drugs they'd found, how the feared 300-pound Gregory Dials had been rendered helpless. Most of all, how small and pathetic the great drug kingpin Eddie Nash turned out to be, how they'd frightened and humiliated him, how they'd made him beg for his life.
Truth is, Sharon feels sorry for Dawn, for what has doubtless been a difficult family situation, for her loneliness as she spends hours in the courtyard with little to do, for her vulnerability to John's manipulation. Deciding the teenager needs support rather than yet another kick in the teeth from life, Sharon lets Dawn move into the back bedroom of their small house. And still, she keeps the pretense alive. She and John share the master bedroom, and Dawn becomes their guest. When John and his brother David make a go of an honest business, opening up a second-hand shop and locksmith service in Glendale, Dawn goes to work as store manager. When the shop inevitably fails, Sharon begins to notice bruises on Dawn's face. There's always an excuse, always a reason apart from the obvious. Sharon doesn't investigate. And when Dawn's emaciated appearance tells the trained nurse that the girl is doing whatever drugs John is into, she doesn't ask questions. The two of them are spending more and more time away from the apartment complex doing God knows what. They return only when they need a place to sleep or a few dollars. By early 1980, whatever semblance of a family life Sharon can convince herself they have is over. It's hard to say what the final insult is. John's further descent into drug addiction, his cheating, the constant lying and stealing. But she can no longer insulate herself from his erratic and destructive behavior. Sharon tells her husband of 15 years to get out. John packs Dawn into the Chevy Malibu, still registered in his wife's name, and they depart the Glendale complex. Sharon goes on with her life. She'll hear from John occasionally when he needs money or a favor of some sort. Once or twice he comes by, but his life is now completely his own, and Sharon wants no more part of it.
By the time the four men got back to the Wonderland house, their inside man, who'd given them the go-ahead from the Chevy Malibu, was waiting for them. Ron Lanius disappeared momentarily into his bedroom and stashed $100,000 of the stolen cash. Then the gang went to the breakfast nook to divide up the rest of the loot. Dumping everything onto the table, they began to sort through the cash, dope, and jewelry. They carefully weighed out 8 pounds of cocaine and a pound of heroin. There were 5,000 quaaludes. Minus the 100,000 squirreled away by Lanius, there was 10,000 in cash. Later in the afternoon, Billy Deverell took the jewelry to be fenced and returned with another 150,000. By early evening, they had assessed the take at over $1 million. When they weren't squabbling over how to divide up the spoils, they were congratulating themselves on a job well done. Again and again, they regaled the women, Susan Lanius, Joy Miller, and Barbara Richardson, with reenactments of the morning's robbery. Then they spent the rest of the night freebasing and shooting up.
On Christmas of 1980, John shows up at Eddie Nash's with a special gift. By now, John and Dawn are living in a series of fleabag motels in Hollywood and the Valley. When they can't afford that, they sleep in the Chevy Malibu. John is freebasing every 15 minutes or so. Unable to pay for the drugs with whatever he can steal or earn as a go-between, he falls further behind to Eddie. The more he owes, the harder it is to get an advance on his next supply. The more desperate he becomes, the more he beats Dawn. By the time he pulls the Malibu in front of the white Studio City house, there's little doubt what will happen if she doesn't comply. He flashes his crazed blue eyes at her as if imparting the secrets of the universe. Remember, he tells her, Eddie has a thing for innocent young girls, so play it up. Don't ask questions. Most of all, she has to be careful. She might be left alone for a while, but it's only a test. There are two-way mirrors in the bedroom. Eddie likes to watch his guests' unguarded moments to see if they'll take anything. John nods at the house and half pushes her out of the car. It won't be the only time. When they need cash for the next fix, he'll send her out on the street to do tricks. If she refuses, he'll beat her. And when she returns from her assigned task, he'll beat her again as if she's cheated on him. Once, he has her sleep with the two men who run his telephone message service in lieu of paying his bill. But mainly it's about the drugs, whatever gets him through the next high. Then he'll get straight and promise never to hurt her again. When she returns an hour later with a quarter ounce of cocaine Eddie gave her in payment, John complains it's not enough. When they get back to the motel room, he beats her again. Then he runs a hot bath for her and scrupulously scrubs every inch of her body as if washing away her sins. It doesn't take long for them to smoke up the coke and John to cycle back to desperation.
The Wonderland gang was under no illusions about the man they'd just robbed. Eddie Nash might not go to the police, but he wouldn't easily forget the humiliation of being victimized in his own home. He had a reputation for getting even, and the stories of bodies lying unclaimed in the desert weren't far from their minds. They hadn't taken precautions to hide their identities, nor had they been shy about talking about the job to anyone who'd listen. Though Nash had never met them in person, it wouldn't be long before he'd figure out who was behind the robbery. When their heads cleared of heroin from their latest binge, they decided this would be their last day on Wonderland Avenue. They were going to find a new base of operations before Eddie could regroup and put out a hit. It made sense, until they decided to shoot up more of the heroin they'd just stolen. They sank into their seats in the living room and floated on their latest high and put off their plans to depart Wonderland. But when they came down, Lanius rethought the decision to leave. With all the weapons in the house, not to mention the iron gate and two barking pit bulls, he felt confident no one could take them by surprise. Of more importance to Lanius, he didn't like the idea of running from anyone, let alone the little, self-important cokehead Eddie Nash. Billy Deverell either agreed or was no longer paying attention. David Lind had gone off to get high with some girls in the valley. Tracy McCourt wasn't as confident. He got spooked when he thought he noticed one of Nash's cars driving up Wonderland. He told the others, but they brushed it off. He gathered his share of the loot and headed over to his apartment in North Hollywood. Lanius and Deverell spent the rest of the day getting high on their stolen dope, retelling the story of the heist, and letting the word out that they were back in business again. Then they fell into a drugged sleep, comfortable in the belief that their Wonderland home was secure.
John eyes the computer in the back seat of a car in the building's parking garage. He's left Dawn upstairs in a Marina Del Rey apartment with Michelle, a hooker friend who runs a brothel out of her small valley apartment. They're meeting a friend of Michelle's who has a lead on a potential job. Tired of living in the Chevy, John has arranged for him and Dawn to move in with the hooker who helped find clients for Dawn while John was out trying to score. When Michelle was off on a job, John would steal from her and blame it on Dawn. If Dawn refused to turn tricks, he would beat her. If that didn't work, he withheld food from the emaciated 20-year-old. Then he would apologize and say it was just the drugs and promise it would never happen again. When one day they got into a confrontation in the car, John swerved to the side of the road. He got out and yanked Dawn out of the car and threw her in the trunk. He drove around until she changed her mind. As John waits for the two women, he keeps looking back at the car. Who would leave a computer like that just sitting on the back seat? He glances around, sees that he's alone in the garage. Damn, if the guy didn't leave the door unlocked. In an instant, the computer's under his arm and he's throwing it into the trunk of the Chevy. When Dawn and Michelle come down, he hustles them into the car and heads toward the exit. As he gets to the gate, the security guard stops him. Next thing, he's being questioned about his movements, asked to open the Chevy's trunk. Inside is the computer. They've been watching him all along on the building's security camera. The police soon arrive, and the three of them, John, Dawn, and Michelle, are hauled off to jail. In a few hours, Eddie posts bail, and John is back on the street. This time, Dawn refuses to return to Michelle's with him. He punches her in the stomach and shoves her into the apartment. Then he orders her to draw him a bath and get him some coffee. She notices that a sliding door has been left unlocked and unguarded. She waits for him to get into the tub. The next time he calls out for his coffee, she's already out the door and running from the apartment complex. She makes it to a nearby Denny's and bums change from a stranger to use the payphone. She calls her mother in Oregon and begs for a ticket to be sent to the Greyhound station in Glendale. The next day, she's on a bus out of California and away from John Holmes.
If there was one thing Detective Tom Lang despised, it was dirty cops. And the more he looked into Eddie Nash, the more corrupt police officials he found. At the start of the investigation, he didn't know much more about Eddie Nash than was common knowledge. But his partner Bob Souza filled in the details. He remembered the club owner from a scandal involving LAPD back in the early 70s. Eddie had always boasted good relations with the police. He would invite officers into his clubs, treat them to dinner, keep the drinks coming. Technically, it might not be considered a bribe, but it smoothed things over. When Eddie's name came up on some police probe or other, maybe his friends on the force would look the other way. It was assumed that Eddie, like a lot of club owners, was involved in drugs, maybe prostitution, but nothing ever came of it. Eddie would brag about how everyone from the chief of police on down was on his payroll, that he owned the sheriff's office as well. Such practices were common in LA at the time. Eventually, some of the cops went to prison on corruption charges. Nash, as he had so often, escaped prosecution. When he was reportedly under the scrutiny of a federal task force, he brushed it off, insisting the fix was in there as well. Such braggadocio certainly fit Nash's image, however self-enhanced. But up until the Wonderland killings, he had not spent a day in jail. Eddie Nash seemed untouchable.
The girl stands at the side of the entrance to the 101, cut-off jeans and a tank top. She shifts from foot to foot, squints in the bright California sunlight. John spots her as he heads up the on-ramp. She doesn't need to stick out her thumb, just smiles as the car approaches. John judges her attractive enough and pulls over to let her in. He flashes that grin halfway between goofy and charming as she slides into the passenger seat. He can't tell whether she recognizes him or not, but convinces himself she does. They get to talking, and pretty soon it's about getting high. He recognizes in her a kindred spirit when it comes to their drug of choice, cocaine. She asks if he has any. Sure, he says. He's got the best shit around. She gives a little laugh and looks out the car window at the highway flying by. No, she says. She's pretty sure her dealers have the best stuff in town. Problem is, she's out. In fact, she's on her way to score right now. John's interest jumps up a notch. He's got a ready supply from Eddie Nash, but always seems to be in debt to the club owner. In fact, he owes him about $1,000 right now, since he tends to use more than he can work off by making deliveries around town. That's the thing about Eddie. He lets you hang out at his place, invites you to partake of his stash, but there's always a price. Eddie might like to play the good host, but at heart he sees himself as a businessman. It's all about the action, the give and take that only makes sense as a zero-sum game, and is only enjoyable if Eddie ends up on top. So John always winds up smoking more than he can pay for, always one advantage down on Eddie. John always owes Eddie something. So maybe this happenstance meeting on the freeway can work to John's advantage. A new dealer might mean a new supply, or better yet, something he can parlay into a middleman relationship, skimming from both sides. It would beat boosting suitcases from the luggage carousel at LAX. John drives the winding canyon roads until the girl points to a house up ahead on the right. He pulls over, watches as she gets out and goes to the iron gate. In a moment, she's buzzed in. She smiles back at him and bounds up the stairs. John studies the house. It's big, with two balconies and a carport. In contrast to the well-tended homes to either side, it's in a state of disrepair. The paint is peeling and the gate is rusted. Weeds are protruding through cracks in the driveway. At the point where John is convinced she's forgotten about him, she reappears on the balcony. "Come on up," she yells down to him. "My friends want to meet you." John gets out of the car. and heads up the stairs to 8763 Wonderland Avenue.
Gregory Dials lay sprawled and naked on the pool table in Eddie Nash's living room, hands cuffed behind his back. It might not have been a good look for the 300-pound bodyguard, but at least he was alive. When police had burst into the house that morning, Dials' instinct had been to pick up a handgun and start shooting. Deputies fired back, yet miraculously, no one was hit. But Dials was headed to jail on the charge of assault with a deadly weapon on a police officer. Eddie Nash might have had a reputation for evading prosecution on various vice charges, but this was a murder investigation. And the more information gleaned by the detectives, the more the trail pointed to Nash. The story told by both David Lind and Tracy McCourt was consistent. Members of the Wonderland gang had broken into the club owner's residence, terrorized him, wounded his bodyguard, and made off with $1 million in cash, drugs, and jewelry. It made sense that a man like Eddie Nash would not rest until he exacted revenge on the perpetrators. The cops had enough to get a search warrant. Only a few days after the murders on Wonderland Avenue, Detectives Lang and Souza showed up at Eddie Nash's door, accompanied by L.A. County Sheriff's deputies. Eddie was made to open the safe in his bedroom. He seemed more annoyed than fearful, insulted that a man of his stature should be treated as a common criminal. It appeared to the two homicide detectives that this wasn't the kind of treatment the nightclub owner had come to expect from LAPD. Before they left, they confiscated $1 million worth of cocaine. Eddie was arrested and posted bond within hours. More significantly, the cops had found items presumed to have been taken from the murder house on Wonderland. But the detectives still didn't have enough to indict Nash for the murders. For one thing, there was no evidence he had been at the house that night. The palm print found on the bed rail near Lanius's body didn't match Eddie or his bodyguard, Gregory Dials. When looking through arrest records, they did, however, find a match. It was to a low-level criminal once charged with pimping and pandering. More recently, he'd been arrested for stealing a computer out of a parked car. Though there were many details to be filled in, Detective Lang felt confident he had enough evidence to bring in a suspect for questioning. Using an outstanding bench warrant for receiving stolen property, the police went looking for John C. Holmes. Next time on the Wonderland Murders, the robbery. After finding John Holmes' palm print at the murder house on Wonderland Avenue, police need to determine if the porn actor was a witness or participant. But what detectives Tom Lang and Bob Souza really want to know is if Holmes will give up Eddie Nash. They're confident Nash ordered the murders in retaliation for the robbery 2 days earlier. If John doesn't cooperate with the police, he could face the death penalty. But if he does, he could face something even worse. Eddie Nash. Subscribe to Hollywood and Crime on Apple Podcasts, Wondery.com, Spotify, or wherever you're listening right now. To find a link to subscribe and for more information on the episode notes, simply tap or swipe over the cover art. You'll also see some offers from our sponsors. Please support our show by supporting them. If you like what you've heard, we'd love you to give us a 5-star rating and review us. And be sure to tell your friends and fans of true crime. We're counting on you to help us spread the word. If you want to hear more of the Wonderland Murder series right away, you can get all 6 episodes ad-free by subscribing now to Wondery Plus. Go to wondery.com/plus. That's P-L-U-S. You'll also get exclusive access to other Wondery shows, in addition to extra content and perks. The Wonderland Murders is written and directed by Larry Brand and produced by Rebecca Reynolds, Tracy Patton, and Jim Carpenter for Hollywood and Crime. Producers wish to thank Jennifer Sugar and Jill C. Nelson, authors of John Holmes, A Life Measured in Inches. Bob Chin, author of The Other Side of Paradise, the uncensored memoirs of Bob Chin, and Julia St. Vincent, director of Exhausted, John C. Holmes, The Real Story. Special thanks to retired LAPD Detective Tom Lang, co-author with Robert Souza of Malice in Wonderland. The Wonderland Murders was recorded at the Invisible Studios, West Hollywood, California. Executive producers Marshall Louie and Hernan Lopez for Wondery.